My name's John Doyle. I'm the executive director of both the Memphis Rock and Soul Museum and the Memphis Music Hall of Fame.
And we're right here in the downtown Memphis, right in the heart of old Memphis, right?
Yeah, we are a few feet from legendary Beale Street, and we're currently at the Memphis Music Hall of Fame, which is our newest museum. Rock and Soul, which was developed by the Smithsonian Institution, was opened in 2000. We opened the Memphis Music Hall of Fame to pay tribute to our legendary musicians in August of 2015. It was actually an expansion of our mission to preserve and tell the story of Memphis music and to perpetuate its legacy.
Did you intentionally want some separation and delineation between the two?
Yeah, it's great they're only a block away from each other, but we did want them to be separate because they have different feels and they have different purposes. The Rock and Soul Museum, since it was developed by the Smithsonian in an incredible way that Performing Songwriter magazine says it's perhaps the best exhibit of American music history in the country. And so as the Smithsonian would do it, it tells that history of Memphis music in an incredible way. The Memphis Music Hall of Fame pays tribute to the heroes of Memphis music, so it's a little more personal with the individuals. Rock and Soul Museum is located at FedEx Forum, which is our premier sports and entertainment complex. That's where the Rolling Stones perform. It's also where the Memphis Grizzlies NBA team performs. Memphis Music Hall of Fame is located adjacent to Hard Rock Cafe, one block to the west. It's at 2nd and Beale Street. Rock and Soul is at 3rd and Beale Street.
Here at the museum, it's focused more on people that performed and played specifically in Memphis.
Yeah, that's right. That's very fair to say. It is exactly what we wanted to do. We wanted, after people visit, and we sell them in combo, people can come to one museum or both, but after you've gone through Rock and Soul, you kind of understand the story.
The bigger picture?
That's exactly right. It's more about the civil rights of black musicians and white musicians coming together to create this sound that totally exploded, put Memphis on in the conscience of every country on the planet because of the musical explosion that happened here and the birth of rock and roll. But there are people behind that. Famous people like Elvis and Jerry Lee and B.B. King.
It seems like there's two levels. We know the stories of musicians who came to Mecca.
Yes,
who
that's
came
exactly
to
right.
Memphis because, like, they came to Nashville.
That's exactly right.
There also, I heard you talking earlier to somebody, there is some indigenous music and modalities that were started and birthed in the high school here. That's
yeah.
a cool story.
Yeah, absolutely. There are, one of the people who was inducted the first year into the Memphis Music Hall of Fame was Professor W.T. McDaniel, who was the first African-American music teacher in our African-American schools when we had Caucasian white schools and African-American schools. And so for the first time, black students were able to be taught music.
They didn't have a music teacher or music
no.
program.
Yeah, the
only
cities,
the white schools
only
did.
The white schools did. As was, you know, the football uniforms were passed down, white schools were taken care of as far as textbooks, special programming like music and art and that sort of thing that wasn't available in the black schools. By Professor McDaniel, who had to share his time between two traditional black high schools, Manassas High School and Booker T. Washington High School, he became a professor for famous musicians like Phineas Newborn, Rufus Thomas, a little later Isaac Hayes. And so when you think about the music that came out of Memphis, Tennessee, and the sounds that came out of Stax and High and Duke Records, if
even,
it were not for him...
But even, yeah, that came out of that high school.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That's
I mean,
cool.
Yeah, Booker T. Washington, which is a few blocks away from the Memphis Music Hall of Fame, one of the top high schools in Memphis today, still very predominantly African-American high school. But when you think about the musicians alone that came out of that high school, it's mind-blowing. And so that's kind of the cool thing. When we started working on the Memphis Music Hall of Fame, and we knew the expected names that everybody in the world knows, but when you start learning the length of it, I mean, you know, everybody knows Timberlake. Do you know that Timberlake was Memphis? Everybody knows, you know, Johnny Cash. They know B.B. King. But the tie-ins of Memphis, Tennessee with all of these musicians. And when we first started on our research about how many inductees should we expect and how long is it going to, you know, will we be through in 10 years or something like that? I've got in file in my office 350 names that hadn't gone in yet. And
how many do you induct each year?
We do about six or seven yeah. each year, you know. And so we started with larger classes when we first started our first couple of years, and now we're at six or seven per year. And I've promised the audiences that come to our induction ceremony each fall. We will, for the next 10, 15 years, every year we will be inducting a chart topper, a Grammy winner, a gold record performer, because that's really, you know, what comes out of Memphis. And it surprised me, many of the folks that, you know, I didn't know about. Maurice White from Earth, Wind, and Fire. You know, obviously the staple singers that came out of Memphis, Tennessee. ZZ Top, who we think of as the little band from Texas, maintained a residence in Memphis for 13 years and recorded some of their biggest albums and biggest hits here.
Do you try and focus on the living over the dead?
No, not necessarily.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's one of the most rewarding things and one of the most challenging things, because people are passionate about music. And so each year when we induct people, I get a series of phone calls. Many of them are very heated. I've been cursed about by people who can't believe that that ZZ Top was inducted before Johnny Cash, which I understand, that the Memphis Horns haven't been inducted yet. It's not a popularity contest.
What's the criterion? Who determines and how?
They have to. We have a national nominating committee. One thing we decided was we wanted it to be done with integrity. And so we have people from one of the greatest drummers performing today, Steve Jordan, who's on the nominating committee, Randy Jackson, who is one of the American Idol judges who understands Memphis music extremely well, both Peter Gronick and Robert Gordon, both prominent authors of music and of Memphis music. As a matter of fact, Peter Gronick recently released the bio of Sam Phillips that has been purchased for movie rights. Then there, Leonardo DiCaprio will be starring in the movie based on Peter Gronick's book. And so we've got people who really know Memphis music and who weigh in on that. I don't choose anyone. No one with the museum chooses anyone.
They independently judge the material sent out to them.
That's exactly right. So criteria-wise, we talked first year, what should those criteria be? Should they have to have been born in Memphis? We hope not, because Elvis wasn't born in Memphis. Jerry Lee, Johnny Cash, B.B. King, you know, none of these folks were born in Memphis. They came to Memphis. You know, that's what Memphis was. Memphis was Mecca, where you came to record music, where this explosion was happening.
And like Nashville today is as much a powerhouse or more so than it ever was.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about Memphis and how its evolution has progressed today.
Yeah, if you want to make it in country music, and you hear it constantly on TV shows like The Voice, etc., I wanted to make it in country music, so I moved to Nashville, you know, which is an industry with skyscrapers and record companies and things like that. Memphis is the birthplace of rock and roll and soul music, the home of the blues. We have maintained an authenticity that musicians come back here to resubmerge themselves in this magical thing that happened here in Memphis, that was a combination of where we were located, that we were a diverse city, that we were surrounded by agriculture, that we sat on the Mississippi River, all these things that played into us being what we are.
And it still remains.
It still reeks with every bit of that. I mean, our studios today, which are first-class, world-class studios, are celebrating this huge honeymoon period, because these A-list artists, who were originally the Keith Richards and the Rod Stewarts who wanted to come to Memphis to record, and now they are the Bruno Mars.
Let's go back in time. Yeah. Keith Richards, at that point in time, what would be the magnetism for him?
When these people in Great Britain, they were introduced to rock and roll music that exploded out of Memphis. They totally worshipped Elvis Presley and all things American. And to them, all things American were all things coming out of Memphis, Tennessee at the time. You know, the Pop Tunes record store would put out a playlist of songs that were selling the best, and the rest of the world looked at that playlist to see, long before we had internet or anything like that, what records are selling at Pop Tunes in Memphis, because that's the next hit maker. And so it totally influenced the British invasion. And, you know, you look at a lot of the band members from Led Zeppelin, from Rolling Stones, who came and who purchased grave markers for blues musicians whose family couldn't afford grave markers, who totally influenced their careers. And so someone like Keith Richards, who came and recorded at legendary Royal Studios, where Al Green recorded, he wanted to go there because he wanted to record into the microphone that Al Green recorded into.
Wow.
And it is more a part of reconnecting. And, you know, Nashville can connect you to a music industry. Memphis can connect you to a musical soul.
The parallel would be Studio B in Nashville.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so we're seeing a lot of it. Like I mentioned, Bruno Mars recorded here year before last. Melissa Etheridge, her latest album, Memphis Rock and Soul, was recorded at Royal Studios as well. Sun Studios, which is a huge tourist attraction, but still a recording studio. Obviously, early on with Rattle and Hum, U2 recorded there. John Mayer has recorded at Royal Studios. They just got finished recording Robert Cray for the second or third time at that studios. And so these folks come here. Jack White has recorded at Electrophonic Studios. Ardent Studios continues to record practically everybody. The list of people who have recorded at Ardent Studios, which they don't promote heavily, but, you know, pretty much anyone in music has recorded at Ardent Studios here in Memphis. And it's about, if you're a musician and you've gone this far in your career, how do you reconnect so that your next 10 years are as powerful as your last 10 years? Memphis can do that for a musician.
That's really fascinating. If you have a couple of minutes, I know it's getting late and people closing up. Let's take a real high-speed walking tour. And as we go, let's start with the legacy and history of this physical building.
History. Sure. The history of it is fascinating because this was, when you're talking about early Memphis, this was Burke's carriage repairs. And so actually carriages were done in this very building, and horses were hoofed and everything like that. But then later than that, store called Lansky Brothers Clothiers, and they were operating on Beale Street in this exact building when Elvis Presley was a young teenager. And so these young musicians who started coming here and buying their clothes here, Hal Lansky, who's now the owner of Lansky's clothing store, his father Bernard Lansky operated it during the heyday of Elvis, tells the great story of Johnny Cash coming into this exact building with a can of Prince Albert tobacco and saying, "Mr. Lansky, I want a coat just like this," the long black coat that Prince Albert wore on the front of that tobacco can. So he brought him up to the second floor where the exhibit is, where we're standing right now, and that's where Johnny Cash bought his very first black coat to become the Man in Black and purchased black from then on from Mr. Lansky and then obviously elsewhere. So the building itself is rich as far as Memphis history. It's rich as far as music history. As far as the exhibit itself, what we look for, because Rock and Soul, which was put together by the Smithsonian, looks very Smithsonian. It's about a story. We wanted this building to be, since it wasn't about a museum story like Rock and Soul was, it is about you connecting with this artist that you really love. Ever since we inducted Justin Timberlake, people have been calling saying, "When is the Justin Timberlake memorabilia going to be installed?" Which is happening 2 weeks from now.
I feel really bad about this. We're getting the 5 minutes sign.
That's okay.
So let's really quick, and I'll have to come back because this I could spend a day here easy.
Absolutely.
Give us a highlight of some of the coolest
stuff.
We
wanted this to be cool belongings to people. Obviously, you have B.B. King's guitar. You've got Isaac Tay's organ. Standing here, you've got clothes from both Isaac Hayes and David Porter, who worked together to do some of the greatest soul songs of all time. A Furry Lewis guitar is almost impossible to find. Most of the blues musicians, they didn't keep their stuff. A lot of times they had to sell it or the family had to sell it in order to bury them. There was a gentleman in North Dakota who owned Furry Lewis's guitar, and we found out about him through Acoustic Guitar Magazine, and we contacted him, asked him if he'd put it in loan at the Memphis Music Hall of Fame, and he said, "You probably want the case as much as you want the guitar," because of course Furry had his name there.
This thing looks amazing.
Like a dinosaur. It's hard to tell on radio, but there is a grand piano that is completely decomposed that is in a pristine white display case. Jim Dickinson, folks have to go online and look up Jim Dickinson, who was one of the greatest producers to come out of Memphis, worked with the Rolling Stones, Ry Cooder, and so many other musicians. And he had a studio in Coldwater, Mississippi, Zebra Ranch. And his sons are now North Mississippi All-Stars, people who know more current music. This was the last piano that came out of Stax Records. It was a white grand piano that Isaac Hayes wrote many of the songs that were recorded at Stax Records. And when Stax closed, Jim Dickinson purchased this piano. He was an eccentric type, and he was an artist. Aside from being a musician, he was an artist. And he loved to create pieces of art and put them outside. He believed in the earth taking things back. and things, the progress of decomposition was part of the whole progress of life and everything.
Well, he got halfway done with that project.
That's exactly right. And so he put this grand piano in front of his studio in Coldwater, Mississippi. And so this grand piano, which stood in front of his studios, the likes of Robert Plant and Robert Palmer even, and Bob Dylan, laid their hands on this as they were going into his studio. And it was decomposing and falling apart. And so his belief was that it was being completely reclaimed and becoming a work of art. So we wanted to display it like a work of art.
Okay, two more are really cool.
We have half of Jerry Lee Lewis's Cadillac. We've got the left half of Jerry Lee Lewis's Cadillac.
Does he still have the right half?
He does have the right half.
In his living room?
No. At Jerry Lee Lewis Cafe and Honky Tonk, which is on Beale Street. The other half of the car is at his restaurant, which is two blocks further down on Beale Street. Elvis's mobile phone, before any of us had mobile phones, were here. Again, we're getting ready to install the coat and tie and bandstand from JT and the Tennessee Kids from Justin Timberlake's 2020 tour. Things from Big Star, Rufus Thomas, the Oscar trophy from 3-6 Mafia that they won for best original score. You know, it's all here, including tons of touch screens where people can test their Memphis music knowledge. Tons of screens where they can see interviews from any of these folks.
And I bet you have a lot of archival stuff that's not on display.
Yeah, plenty of stuff. And the great thing about the Memphis Music Hall of Fame, it evolves every year because we induct new people, and with that comes new stories, new memorabilia.
Sadly and regretfully, gotta say sayonara.
Memphis will always be here, so even though you have to sign off now, folks can come here to this great city and we will always be here. Anyone's welcome here anytime. My name again is John Doyle, director of Memphis Music Hall of Fame. You can find us online, memphismusichalloffame.com, and contact us anytime and come see us.
John, what a pleasure. Thank you. It was great to meet you and great to come here even though it was almost midnight.
Thanks for giving us a break. Appreciate it.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Memphis, Tennessee.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com. Our associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Kim Schneider from Michigan, Elaine Masters in San Diego, Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon, and Steve Cook, contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkansongs on NPR affiliate KUAR.